Tools for Narrative Analysis, Social Movement Theory. Social Movement Theory. Social movement theory is a useful paradigm to analyze insurgent narratives and understand how they promote collective action. This is particularly the case in a subfield of social movement theory that considers the concept of framing. Social movement theory was originally developed by sociologists to understand the formation and evolution of a variety of movements, such as the civil rights movement and the pro-life movement in the United States. Although this theory was initially applied to mostly nonviolent social movements, the tools and framework are also applied to violent insurgent movements. It is important to note that narrative, the subject of this work, is only one pillar of social movement theory. In isolation, narrative framing is unlikely to effectively mobilize without consideration for the remaining two pillars, political opportunity and resource mobilization. Political opportunity is a concept used to explain how the larger political environment alters the perception of chances of success or failure in resistance movements. The second, resource mobilization, explains how groups leverage existing and acquired resources, whether financial, technical, or organizational, that enable resistance movements to emerge and sustain their operations. In other words, resistance movements cannot rely on narratives alone to achieve their goals. However, where appropriate, we focus solely on the role that narratives can play in overcoming the many difficulties resistance movements face in mobilizing others to join and actively support their goals. A fundamental concept within social movement theory is that of a frame. Irving Goffman first defined frames as schemata of interpretation that enable people to locate, perceive, identify, and label events that they experience or are brought to their attention. More simply, a frame represents a worldview or paradigm through which events and concepts are interpreted, and as such, it represents a means through which meaning is constructed and reality is interpreted. Within the context of a social movement, by assigning motives and meanings, a frame can help overcome the collective action problem that is inherent in many insurgencies. As such, Robert Benford and David Snow, in their annual review of sociology article, Framing Processes and Social Movements, define a collective action frame as an action-oriented set of beliefs and meanings that inspire and legitimate the activities and campaigns of a social movement organization. Thus, collective action frames perform an interpretive function by simplifying and condensing the world out there, especially in ways, quote, intended to mobilize potential adherents and constituents, to garner bystander support, and to demobilize antagonists, end quote. A key aspect of a collection action frame is that it is, quote, not merely aggregations of individual attitudes and perceptions, but also the outcome of negotiating shared meanings, end quote, such as, say, through narratives, writings, and the exchange of ideas among a community of people. Benford and Snow noted that collective action frames perform three core framing tasks, specifically diagnostic framing, prognostic framing, and motivational framing. The first involves identifying the problem and its victim and attributing the problem to responsible actors and causes. The second entails specifying a proposed solution and a strategy for carrying out corrective action. The third provides a rationale for engaging in remedial collective action, including an appropriate vocabulary of motive. Each of these concepts can be fruitfully applied to various insurgencies. For insurgent groups, many diagnostic frames are essentially injustice frames that identify the population from which the group emerged as a victim of what the group regards as a historical injustice perpetuated by some other actor. For instance, the diagnostic frame of the Palestine Liberation Organization, PLO, encompassed a narrative that focused on the loss of Palestinian land to Jewish settlers. The displacement of much of the original Palestinian population to the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and surrounding Arab countries, and the establishment of a Jewish state on most of the British Mandate Palestine. In the case of the Shining Path, the diagnostic frame centered on the arrival of the Spanish and the downfall of the Inca Empire in the 16th century as the cause of the current economic and social misfortune of the indigenous population of Peru. There are several things to note regarding diagnostic frames for insurgent groups. First, depending on the structural setting of an insurgency, that is, the evolution of social, economic, political, and international conditions from which an insurgent group emerged, history may or may not play an important role in informing a diagnostic frame. In some cases, the weight of history will be heavy, as history will essentially provide the basis on which a diagnostic frame will be initially developed. In some cases, history will provide an original sin that will inform the initial narrative of an insurgency. It may also provide the set of actors, as well as their corresponding actions and group grievances that populate the discourse of a diagnostic frame. For instance, the grievances that inform the diagnostic frame of the Shining Path originated from an event more than 400 years in the past. In the case of Shia revolutionaries who flocked to Hezbollah in Lebanon and overthrew the Shah in Iran, an original sin from 1,300 years before, the death of Hussein ibn Ali in the Battle of Karbala in 680 AD, provided some of the raw material that informed a diagnostic frame. In other cases, history is less influential. The grievances that motivated the movement for the emancipation of the Niger Delta in Nigeria were based on the actions of the Nigerian government and not on, for example, the actions of the British during the colonial era. However, to keep a diagnostic frame fresh and dynamic, an insurgent group may engage in armed propaganda to provide events from the present with which to update the frame. The process is similar to vertical integration, described in the Structure and Components of Persuasive Narrative section of this study. Armed propaganda actions help to produce new meanings and reality from which to generate an updated narrative. In one example, an insurgent group may take actions designed to lead to an excessively violent reaction by the government, thus calling into question the latter's legitimacy. Or the government's reaction may reveal its incompetence, leading the audience to question the government's ability to provide for security, further undermining its legitimacy. As an example, at one point the Peruvian government's response to the terrorism, assassinations, and sabotage unleashed by the Shining Path was regarded as incompetent and ineffectual, which in turn led to less support for the government, and in fact, greater sympathy for the insurgents. Another important aspect of diagnostic frames is that they can be highly contested. Social movement theorists sometimes speak of a social movement industry. This mixture of various social movement organizations may engage in debates among themselves regarding the nature of the problem, for instance, the diagnostic frame, and consequentially, what is to be done about the problem, for instance, the prognostic frame. For instance, a variety of Palestinian groups emerged to challenge Israel. Some, like the Fatah-led PLO, eventually came to recognize Israel and consequently developed a diagnostic frame that centered on the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Other groups, such as Hamas, took a maximalist stance by refusing to recognize Israel. So their diagnostic frame is notable in that it identifies the problem as Israel's existence rather than simply its occupation of a portion of land between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea. These differences between diagnostic frames naturally lead to differences in prognostic frames, for instance, negotiations as opposed to perpetual resistance against Israel. And indeed, such differences have led to internecine fighting between Hamas and Fatah. A group's motivational frame essentially represents a call to arms, and it is here where one sees an effort to overcome collective action problems. Clearly, the motivational frames of insurgent groups emphasize the need to forcefully address historical and modern-day grievances. However, sometimes the most effective motivational frames are those that equate actions with affirmation of identity, personal significance, and even personal salvation. For instance, racial animosity against Peru's white elite was one of the motivating factors behind the rise of the Shining Path. In meetings in Ayacucho, attendees often heard statements such as, "Necesitamos un gobierno de indios," we need a government of Indians, and
Hay que matar a los blancos y destruir las ciudades que siempre nos han explotado.
We have to kill the whites and destroy the towns that have always exploited us. Another example is provided by Iranian clerics and jurists both before and after the 1979 Iranian Revolution. In speeches and through the bully pulpit offered by Friday congregational sermons, khutbah, reinstated after the revolution, various Iranian jurists and prayer leaders extolled the notion of martyrdom by equating self-sacrifice to an honorable death in support of the revolution. The exemplary martyrdom of the Shia imams at the advent of Islam provided the blueprint. Martyrdom in the defense of the Islamic government was therefore imbued with deep personal significance, as it offered a direct path to personal and eternal salvation in the afterlife, and in fact, a privileged position in the ever after right next to the pantheon of martyred Shia imams. For instance, before the revolution, the discourse and work of Dr. Ali Shariati, an Iranian sociologist and one of the chief ideologues of the revolution, represent an exegesis in which the author expounded on the concepts of jihad and shahadat, martyrdom. In a speech titled Jihad and Shahadat, Shariati noted that a shahid is one who negates his whole existence for a sacred ideal and goal. The canonical example is provided by the martyrdom of Hussein ibn Ali, who consciously welcomed death by choosing to fight the forces of Yazid, the Umayyad caliph, whom Hussein regarded as an illegitimate ruler. Shariati argued that Hussein chose to engage in battle knowing it would lead to his demise, quote, so that the consequences of his act might be widely spread, and the cause for which he gives his life might be realized sooner. Hussein chose shahadat as an end for the affirmation of what is being negated and mutilated by the political apparatus, end quote. The shahid prior to his martyrdom engages in collective action, even in the face of impossible odds, not only because of the propagandistic value of the deed itself, but also because it represents the choice of death over dishonor. In contrast, a mujahid, for instance a person engaged in jihad, is a sincere warrior who dies for his or her faith, but does not consciously choose shahadat. Rather, mujahids may die in the line of fire, as an unintended outcome of fighting for one's faith. Thus, according to Asaf Mogadam in the article Mayhem, Myths, and Martyrdom, quote, shahadat is an invitation to all generations in all ages. If you cannot kill your oppressor, then die. End quote. Shariati called on Muslims to resist the corruption of society through shahadat by seeking the red death of martyrs rather than to die the black death of cowards. From the perspective of social movement theory, the invocation of Shariati to choose shahadat represents a motivational frame. Within this frame, collective action is encouraged because the underlying individual act of self-obliteration is sanctified by its positive juxtaposition with the example of Hussein's martyrdom. In turn, the frame implies a privileged place in the afterlife with this most sacred of imams. The invocation of Hussein's example, embodying self-sacrifice for the Iranian Revolution and evoking deep personal significance, continued after the fall of the Shah, during khutbah, the Friday congregational sermons. Hagai Ram, in his book Myth and Mobilization in Revolutionary Iran, noted that prayer leaders often cited the following Quranic verse, quote, and reckon not those who are killed in Allah's way as dead, nay, they are alive and are provided sustenance from their Lord, rejoicing in what Allah has given them out of His grace, and they rejoice for the sake of those who, being left behind them, have not joined them, that they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve. End quote. Quran 3:169-179. In one Friday prayer in September 1979, Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Telekani, commenting on the preceding passage, noted that true martyrs find delight and joy in their self-abnegation because they are rewarded with eternal life by God, who takes care of all their needs. In a sermon in March 1980, Hojat al-Islam Sayyid al-Khamenei, the current supreme leader of Iran, stated that the martyrs are addressing us, saying, you must continue our way, and that they want us to guard the heritage of their blood,
that is, the Islamic Republic and the victory of the Islamic Revolution. Additionally, the martyrs are encouraging us to hold the Quran in one hand and a gun in the other to wage war against all plots and cowardliness. In a sermon in October 1979, Ayatollah Hussein Ali Montazeri, commemorating Iranians killed in combat against Kurds in the Kurdish region of Iran, noted that the former were martyrs who drank the elixir of martyrdom. As such, they were, quote, gathered with the martyrs of the advent of Islam, end quote. In other sermons, prayer leaders claimed that martyrs did not feel the pain of their mortal blows when they died on the battlefield. In a sermon given in September 1981, Hojat al-Islam Ali Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani, who would become a prominent figure in the Islamic Republic, stated that, quote, they, Shahids, don't feel any pain when struck by a bullet, an arrow, a spike, or a dagger. They don't see Israel, the angel of death. They only see God, end quote. In April 1983, Rafsanjani told a congregation that once the bullet strikes the body of our warriors, they are carried on the angel's wings to paradise, where they reside by the prophet of God. From the perspective of social movement theory, these statements represent the construction of a motivational frame with a clear message and incentive to engage in collective action. Self-obliteration for the sake of the Islamic Revolution is a deeply personal act that is sanctified by virtue of its congruence with the exemplary action of the Shahadat of Hussein ibn Ali. Additionally, Shahadat in defense of the Islamic Republic will garner eternal life in paradise alongside the canonical imams of Shia Islam. Social movement theory also provides a number of concepts related to processes of frame development and elaboration that may be useful to the operator in deciphering insurgency narratives. One such concept is that of frame articulation. Benford and Snow define this concept as follows. Quote, frame articulation involves the connection and alignment of events and experiences so that they hang together in a relatively unified and compelling fashion. Slices of observed, experienced, and/or recorded reality are assembled, collated, and packaged. What gives the resultant collective action frame its novelty is not so much the originality or newness of its ideational elements, but the manner in which they are spliced together and articulated, such that a new angle of vision, vantage point, and/or interpretation is provided. End quote. Thus, in some situations, the narrative espoused by an insurgency reflects themes and ideas that are well known among a populace. Despite the audience's familiarity with the material, the narrative becomes novel by virtue of how its component elements are woven together in a compelling story, in which causality, attribution, and corrective action are clear and resonate with the target audience. The result is a social construction of a reality and meaning that may resonate with the segment of the population that an insurgent group wants to mobilize. Before the emergence of the Shining Path, mestizos and Amerindians in Peru were aware of the accumulated grievances. They could readily see their inferior economic, political, and social status relative to the country's white population. They also noted that their diminished status and prospects originated with the original sin of the arrival of the Spanish hundreds of years before. The novelty of the Shining Path's message, though, was its ability to tie together through diagnostic, prognostic, and motivational frames the various elements of the circumstance. The nature of the problem and its cause, social, political, and economic marginalization brought about by the Spanish and their descendants in Peru, corrective action, a Maoist insurgency followed by the reorganization of the political and economic system along revolutionary socialist lines, and a reason for engaging in collective action, to restore the greatness of the Inca civilization that was despoiled with the arrival of the Spanish. Another important concept is that of frame extension. Just as any effective marketing campaign tailors its message to different segments of the population, an insurgent group often tailors its message depending on the target audience. For instance, the Shining Path emphasized the lack of economic opportunities in messaging aimed at educated mestizos, while stressing vague notions of injustice, racial grievance and economic disparity in messaging aimed at Highland Amerindians. In Vietnam, although the National Liberation Front for South Vietnam, NLF, was sponsored by North Vietnam, the latter, as well as the Viet Cong, hoped that the NLF would appeal to non-communist elements. Hence, appeals to non-communist segments of the population in South Vietnam stressed the NLF's independence from Hanoi. Lastly, another important concept that will likely be relevant for many insurgency narratives is that of frame transformation. Benford and Snow define frame transformation as the changing of old understandings and meanings and/or generating new ones. When history provides much of the ontology or raw material for an initial insurgency narrative, the narrative is likely to be replete with examples of frame transformations in which the crafters of the narrative reinterpret a glorious and mythical past to encourage desired collective action. The case of the Islamic Revolution again provides a rich source of material through which to observe the elaboration of frame transformation. In particular, through their discourse, Iranian clerics strove to overturn a quietist tradition in Shia Islam that shunned activity in politics stretching back a millennium. Rahm noted that this tradition originated in the middle of the 8th century when the 6th Imam, Ja'far al-Sadiq, forfeited his right to political rule and other political roles reserved for the imam. Furthermore, the alleged occultation of the 12th imam, the Mahdi or Messiah, an event that supposedly took place in 873 to 874, depoliticized the Shia further. Members of the sect internalized the futility of gaining power, resigning themselves to suffering what they must in anticipation of the return of the Mahdi. After the revolution, Iranian clerics used the institution of the khutbah to overturn this passive conception of Shia Islam and to argue instead for its revolutionary nature. In some cases, this argument was advanced through a contrast with different Western ideologies. In Friday sermons in September 1981, Rafsanjani criticized the school of thought of Marx and Lenin for viewing Islam and religion in general as an opiate that kept the masses subdued. For Rafsanjani, the Islamic Revolution of 1979 revealed the falsity of such charges because it demonstrated that religion was, quote, the greatest stimulant of the masses, end quote, and that Islam was the most effective ideology of revolution. In 1988, Khamenei noted that, as opposed to materialist ideologies such as communism and capitalism that view individual will as determined and thus not autonomous, Islam teaches that human beings possess free will and are autonomous with respect to their social action and choices. To support this revolutionary conception of Shia Islam, prayer leaders often cited Quranic verse 13:11, quote, "Surely, Allah does not change the condition of a people until they change their own condition," end quote. And based on it, Rafsanjani, in a February 1982 sermon, argued that humanity is not a deterministic movement, but rather a voluntary movement that should be initiated by society, by the people themselves. Thus, according to Islam, quote, "the basis of revolution and the condition for the progression of a revolution is man," end quote, as written in Myth and Mobilization in Revolutionary Iran by Haggai Rahm. Iranian clerics also rehabilitated the earthly careers of various Shia imams. The clerics emphasized the imams' steadfast devotion to God in their heroic efforts to establish an Islamic government, as opposed to their gloomy and sorrowful defeat against Sunni temporal power. In a May 1981 sermon, Khamenei noted that all of the imams, quote, "struggled, they waged jihads, they endured persecution, imprisonment, banishment, and martyrdom," end quote, for the establishment of an Islamic government. In fact, prayer leaders depicted all of the prophets since Abraham as struggling against oppression, and depicted the effort to overthrow the Shah to establish an Islamic government as a continuation of their efforts. One sermon from May 1984 noted that, quote, "Moses revolted against the Pharaohs, Abraham against Nimrod and the Nimrods, Jesus against the tyrants of his time, and Muhammad, too, delivered the people from the hands of oppressive rulers." In contrast to what some self-interested people say, that the prophets had always been instruments of oppressors, they always stood up against the taghuts, tyrants, idolaters. End quote. In August 1980, Khamenei noted that our Islamic revolution was, therefore, a resumption of the revolution of the prophets, because it stood up against injustice from its inception against the oppressors who rule Iran. The canonical example, of course, is that of the martyrdom of Hussein ibn Ali. But rather than reciting the pre-existing clerical view of the example of Ali, which stressed the avoidance of useless resistance and of politics in general, Iranian clerics after the revolution reinterpreted the myth of the Shahadat of Ali as signifying the importance of the struggle against perceived oppression and superior power. Hussein, noted Ayatollah Ruhollah Mousavi Khomeini, the undisputed leader of the revolution, quote, taught us how to struggle against all the tyrants of history, showed us how the clenched fists of those who seek freedom may triumph over tanks, machine guns, and the armies of the Satan. Hussein taught us that if a tyrant rules despotically over the Muslims in any age, we must rise up against him, however unequal our forces may be, and that if we see the very existence of Islam in danger, we must sacrifice ourselves and be prepared to shed our blood. End quote. We can see, therefore, that social movement theory provides a useful framework to deconstruct insurgency narratives and understand how they promote collective action. Many narratives are likely to encompass diagnostic, prognostic, and motivational frames that identify the nature of the problem as well as its victims and culprits, corrective actions to be taken, and a rationale for voluntarily engaging in self-sacrificing collective action to achieve a desired end state. Effective motives will likely be those that imbue individual action with deep and lasting personal meaning. And signification of individual acts may be accomplished through the reinterpretation and glorification of an existing tradition. Myth matures and the myth-symbol complex. In pre-revolutionary Iran, Islamic political entrepreneurs infused important Shia cultural and religious symbols in order to persuade others to collectively mobilize. In the previous section, we explored how social movement theory can help us understand the basic components of this persuasive narrative. However, this phenomenon can also be analyzed within a broader process encompassing the construction and mobilization of a variety of emotive symbols to effectuate ethnogenesis and promote ethnic solidarity and collective action. In his work, The Ethnic Origin of Nations, Anthony Smith noted that many ethnic communities can trace their ideational origins to a living past consisting of a collection of myths, memories, values, and symbols, which he termed a myth-symbol complex. This complex contains a kernel, termed a myth mature, which helps constitute an ethnic group. More specifically, Smith noted, quote, there is also an important aesthetic dimension. Ethnic symbols provide satisfying forms, and ethnic myths are conveyed in apt genres for communication and mobilization. As they emerge from the collective experiences of successive generations, the myths coalesce and are edited into chronicles, epics, and ballads, which combine cognitive maps of the community's history and situation with poetic metaphors of its sense of dignity and identity. The fused and elaborated myths provide an overall framework of meaning for the ethnic community, a myth mature, which makes sense of its experiences and defines its essence. Without a myth mature, a group cannot define itself to itself or to others, and cannot inspire or guide collective action. End quote. Hence, a myth mature is generative. It plays a fundamental role in constructing ethnic groups. Additionally, it emerges from a variety of media, including the written and spoken word, as well as from various cultural performances, such as plays, epics, and ballads. What are the contents of a myth mature? Smith noted a number of component myths, and narratives play a fundamental role in constructing and sanctifying these myths. First, there is the myth of temporal origins, or when we were begotten, and the corresponding myth of location and migration, or where we came from and how we got here. various ethnically based insurgencies contain origin myths that address these two questions. For instance, many of the European Jews who fought for a Jewish state in Palestine believed that the Torah provided the Jews with a title deed to the land. The religious among them trace their origin to Abraham, a shepherd from Ur in southern Mesopotamia who moved his family to Haran in modern-day Turkey and then to Canaan following God's revelation. Quote, "Go forth from your land and from your birthplace and from your father's house to the land that I will show you, and I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you, and I will aggrandize your name, and you shall be a blessing." End quote. Torah, Genesis 12, 1 and 2. Based on these clues, scholars believe that Abraham made his way to Canaan around 2100 BC, although archaeology has yet to confirm the historical accuracy of the stories told about Abraham. Another ethnic group motivated by sanctified accounts of their temporal and spatial origins is the Sinhalese, who believed that they were given a divine right to rule over the entire island of Sri Lanka to nurture and propagate Buddhism. The canonical text that describes the origin of the Sinhalese is the Mahavamsa, and it notes that the progenitor of the Sinhalese race, Vijaya, arrived with his followers to the island from North India more than 2,500 years ago, precisely on the day in 543 BC when the Sinhalese believed the Buddha died. Indeed, the Sinhalese believe that the Buddha designated the island as a repository for his religion. The Mahavamsa has the Buddha stating, quote, "Vijaya, son of King Sinabahu, is come to Lanka from the country of Lala, together with 700 followers. In Lanka, O Lord of Gods, will my religion be established. Therefore, carefully protect him and his followers and Lanka." End quote. Other notable component myths include the myth of the heroic age, or how we were freed and became glorious, the myth of decline, or how we fell into a state of decay, and the myth of regeneration, or how to restore the golden age and renew our community as in the days of old. Readers familiar with the Old Testament will be aware that Exodus and the Davidic kingdom represent high points in the history of the ancient Israelites, but there are a number of other examples of groups conceiving of a mythic and heroic past and offering explanations for subsequent decline and strategies for regeneration. For the Sinhalese, the ascension of King Dutukamunu to the throne in 161 BC is portrayed in the Mahavamsa in a heroic light, as it came after a long campaign against Ilara, a Tamil prince from the southern Indian Kola dynasty. As the Mahavamsa stated, his war cry was, "Not for kingdom, but for Buddhism." For some Sinhalese nationalists, particularly those who believe that the Sinhalese came from superior Aryan stock, Sinhalese civilization entered into decline with the arrival of vulgar Europeans in the 16th century. One such Sinhalese Buddhist nationalist who believed in the racial superiority of the Sinhalese over the other ethnic and religious groups in Sri Lanka was Anagarika Dharmapala. Writing during the British colonial period, Dharmapala noted that, quote, "From the day the white man set foot on this island, the arts and sciences and the Aryan customs of the Sinhalese have gradually disappeared, and today the Sinhalese have to kiss the feet of the Moor and the dastardly Tamil." End quote. How should the Sinhalese recover their greatness? For Dharmapala, the answer was simple. Quote, "My message to the young men of Ceylon is, believe not the alien who is giving you arak whiskey, toddy, sausages, who makes you buy his goods at clearance rates. Enter into the realms of our King Dutukamunu in spirit, and try to identify yourself with the thoughts of that great king who rescued Buddhism and our nationalism from oblivion." End quote. Accounts of decline and strategies for renewal and uplift are also common among Islamic fundamentalist groups. Many argue that the decline of the Islamic world relative to the West was caused by the movement away from the true Islam practiced during the Golden Age of the time of the Prophet. Ayatollah Khomeini told his followers that Iranian people were led astray, and your greatest misfortune is that you forgot Islam. The most important cause of the victory of the revolution was the very same revival of the values of Islam and faith. In fact, for Iran's revolutionary clerics, Islam had always been a revolutionary faith, and previous court ulema who had propagated a quietist version of Shi'ism were guilty of giving service to oppressive rulers because they had stupefied the minds of the faithful by concealing the inherent liberating nature of Islam. Another type of myth that may motivate various insurgencies, especially those that are ethnically based, is what Smith terms the myth of ethnic election. In this myth, a group is convinced of its own exceptionalism by virtue of divine selection. The Sinhalese believe that they were entrusted with the development of Buddhism. This belief in their divine election proved to be an obstacle in their conflict with the Tamils, because it contributed to the belief that any concessions to the latter would foster separatism and ultimately lead to the dismemberment of sacred territory. Another example, of course, is the belief of religious Zionists. The Zionists maintain that God reserved the land of Palestine and beyond for the Jewish people, as indicated in the Torah, quote, "To your seed, Abraham's descendants, I have given this land, from the river of Egypt until the great river, the Euphrates River. The Kenites, the Kenizzites, and the Kadmonites, and the Hittites, and the Perizzites, and the Rephaim, and the Amorites, and the Canaanites, and the Girgashites, and the Jebusites." End quote. Torah, Genesis 15:18-21. Yet there is nothing unique about these two cases. In fact, Smith noted that beliefs in exceptionalism rooted in presumed divine election have been prevalent throughout the Middle East and Europe. In Russia, the Tsars and the Orthodox Russian clergy characterized Moscow as a third Rome. After its conversion to Orthodox Christianity by St. Gregory in 301 AD, the Mountain Kingdom of Armenia cemented a belief in its divine mission on the basis of it being the first Christian nation. Such myths, as noted by Smith, have the potential to mobilize believers for collective action. Quote, "In all these instances, myths of ethnic election have helped to mobilize communities and ensure their survival over long periods. Because the ethnic myth is a dramatic tale that links the present with a communal past, and one that is widely believed, it helps to draw the members into a distinctive community, conferring on them a special aura, that of the elect. Through its symbolism, it strives to unify different classes and regions, spreading ethnic culture outwards from the urban centers and the specialist strata, who guard the traditions, thereby creating a more participant society." End quote. An accompanying belief is that of an ethnoscape. Ethnoscapes are geographical spaces that, according to Smith, have been invested through various types of narratives, such as epics, ballads, and chronicles, over time with powerful emotional connotations and cultural meanings for a particular ethnic group. Examples abound in history, such as Mother Russia, Zion Jerusalem, Al-Quds, Kosovo Polje, Ulster, Tamil Elam for Sri Lankan Tamils, and the entire island of Sri Lanka itself for Sinhalese Buddhists in Sri Lanka. An ethnoscape may be the resting place of our ancestors, or it may also be the site where miracles allegedly occurred and prophets are buried. Additionally, a territory may become sanctified as an ethnoscape over time if it is the site of repeated performance of sacred acts in accordance with a divine mission, where the territory itself is a reward for the faithful observance of a sacred covenant. This collection of myths and symbols is a powerful pull on the consciousness of believers, who are sometimes willing to kill others and sacrifice life and limb to uphold such beliefs. Indeed, one theory from the field of political science, symbolic politics theory, argues that extreme ethnic violence, rather than being caused by conflicts of interest or uncertainty regarding the intentions of opposing groups or whether they can commit to a settlement, is actually caused by the presence of hostile myths of other groups, perhaps based in part on the component myths identified by Smith, in combination with fears of group extinction. The Special Operations Forces practitioner, therefore, will need to be mindful of how adherence to powerful sacred myths can help overcome the collective action problem by providing a powerful motivation to engage in violent collective action to further the material or ideational interests of a particular group.